This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, fitted breastplates and feminine mystique, sexist absurdities in speculative fiction. I want props for saying that without stuttering.
You do deserve an award for that. I got a stutter just listening to you. But also, it's your own fault because you were the one who came up with the title.
Yes, I was. So I set myself the challenge there. Right, well, we came up with this topic not because of anything in particular that's happened, but it's just something that's been kind of brewing at the back of my mind for a little while. And then when I sat down and actually really wrote out some of these tropes and things that are, well, you know, basically quite sexist, and I think they don't necessarily get noticed as being sexist because we are geared towards a norm that accepts them, I realised I had a massive long list. And so it really gave us something to discuss.
Yeah. Also, it's just, this is another episode of Jules has strong feelings about something. And actually, I think I agree with you. When Jules first sort of mentioned the episode, I was like, oh, but God, I've been actually waiting to do something like this for a while, because the same as you, it's sort of been brewing. And I think the moment you start thinking about it, you really start to pick up a lot of things whilst watching and reading content, which you might otherwise have completely ironed over.
Yeah, definitely. Now, when we're saying sexist, I'm afraid, you know, there's only so many words I can put into a title, but we are kind of also looking at genderphobic or transphobic issues here as well. We won't go into as much detail because the episode is just not going to be long enough for that, and we've done some bumper episodes recently. But I will make the point of saying here that when some of these sexist tropes are used, the real problem for sort of the trans community and the non-binary community, etc., anyone who expresses their gender different than the, just the male-female polarities, is the fact that they just get erased entirely by some of these gender issues. So we will mention that as we go on through as well, and perhaps we'll look at that side of things more in depth in a future episode. But I just want to say, you know, we do see you. It's just that we'll start here and we'll see where we get to, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's the general problem of basically trying to put the entirety of humanity into two groups.
Yeah.
And say that these groups are definable. It's just a bit, I mean, there's only really kind of two groups that you can put humanity into, and that's dead or alive.
Yeah, pretty much.
And there's still some middle ground there.
There's still some middle ground, depending on interpretation, but that's a tangent and I'm not going to follow it.
Going to go down that lane.
See, I've got my notes here. Jules wanders down memory lane, so I think I better do that bit next.
Yes.
I've mentioned this before, this will come as no surprise to a regular podcast listener, and that is the fact that growing up, there was a dearth of really good female characters in speculative fiction for me, and the ones who were kind of there in a novelty factor rather than being fully rounded characters. Obviously there were exceptions, but some of those exceptions have kind of still fallen into the trope trap. I will make the point of saying that not all of these tropes are bad in and of themselves. Sometimes it's how they're used. And also, some of the books and films I'm going to mention are not intrinsically harmful or anything, but they're not perfect. And because I've watched them, read them a lot, then they're good examples because I can draw on them easily. That doesn't mean I don't still like them. It just means I'm not going to be blind to the flaws.
Yeah.
That was pretty good, actually, for me. I didn't, like, completely disappear down memory lane there.
You didn't. You see, I was gearing myself up because Jules' notes say Jules wanders down memory lane. And my notes say Madeleine recalls her to the task in hand. But I didn't actually need to. I was geared up. I was ready to call you back, Jules, like, you know, like a psychic trying to get in touch with the other side, but it didn't happen.
I've deprived you now.
You've deprived me. I was looking forward to this. I was looking forward to your tangent, but you didn't have it. I'm heartbroken.
The real issue with not being able to find characters that you can identify with in fiction, when you're growing up particularly, but certainly later on in life as well, is the fact that it sort of reinforces things like gender bias. And in things like fantasy and science fiction, where generally things tend to be open to question more than they are in sort of contemporary fiction a lot of the time, you would hope that there's less of this polarization and this gender bias, but unfortunately that wasn't my experience growing up, which sort of left me feeling, along with everything else, that I was very much sort of othered and on the outside because I wasn't fitting in with what was expected of my assigned gender. Obviously I am female, and I'm fine with being female. It's just I'm not female within these narrow parameters.
Yeah. And I think also the other problem is that not only are we enforcing this gender bias, we're internalizing it as well.
Yeah.
Well, particularly in young female readers who basically don't see themselves represented and come to associate all the exciting things with being male and all of the domestic things, as it were, with being female. And, you know, the domestic things could also be exciting. The exciting things could also be domestic, if that makes sense. And the problem is that the moment you just start to channel everything into one gender and one gender alone, you internalize ideas about your own capability and your own role in life. And it leads to women being quite harmful to one another, I think. And you get these famous lines, I'm not like the other girls.
Yeah.
So, as if being a girl is intrinsically bad, or as if girls are all the same and you are the oddity, rather than saying, actually, we're all different.
Yeah, definitely. So that's reason for challenging these tropes, or at least noticing they're there. That doesn't mean you can't still obviously like the books and films that sort of engage in these tropes. And you never know, 20 years time, someone might be looking back at my books, if they survive that long, and saying, oh, but she did this and she did that and all these things were bad as well. And that's understandable because things move on. We've made a lot of progress in the last 20 years. And it might be a case of I've included things now that I've internalized because I haven't actually sort of interrogated them for whether they're dodgy or not. I've done the best I can with what I had at the time. So this isn't me just throwing things at books that were written 60 years ago or what have you.
Yeah. And there's also, as I said, there's nothing wrong with actually using these tropes to this day. As you said, Jules, it's just about the fact that you've got to be conscious of how they've been used in the past. And you've got to ask yourself, you are using them. Because you may want a feature who is incredibly motherly, and that's absolutely fine, no problem at all. But again, analyze why you're doing it. Feel free to do it, but look at why and look at the history of it first.
Yeah. So we're going to whip through this list that I sort of came up with and just give a few examples where it works, where it doesn't work for us, and why things are slightly problematic.
Yeah. So, shall we start with powerful women are threatening to men?
Yeah, that's a good one, because on the surface, it looks like it looks like equality. It looks like, oh, I've reversed things. I've gender bent it. So we have this, for example, and I love Dune by Frank Herbert. I really, really do. It's one of my favourite books. And I love the Bene Gesserit, which is a sisterhood of women who basically have this massive breeding programme across the galaxy. But when you look at it, that's not great. It's not great segregating genders like that and saying, well, the Bene Gesserit are only women, because obviously that's counting out anyone who doesn't conform to either male or female for a start. And then the fact they exist for a breeding program, so that's an extension of, well, women's function is to be mothers, etc. So you're extending it in this supposedly or seemingly cool sci-fi way, because they're pulling the strings on the galaxy kind of thing. And the fact is, they are threatening. The first thing we see from the Bene Gesserit in the book Dune is the Mother Superior waking Paul up in order to torture him to see if he's a potential Kwisatz Haderach. So basically a messiah-type character. Which is really interesting and everything. And it's a great start, and you certainly get the feeling that Mother Gaius Helena Mohem is actually really kind of a ball breaker, and you never feel that she's anything but that. But at the same time, that's a very twisted, segregated gender role thing going on right there.
Yeah. It makes me think about the Amazons. Interestingly enough, Amelia and I were talking about this recently, and about that the Amazons, within sort of the Greek mythos, was this tribe of warrior women who couldn't really have existed, because apparently, according to Greek mythos, they were meant to be the most fierce and the most terrifying warriors, and yet in every sort of Greek myth they get defeated. Have you noticed that? And it's this weird thing whereby these titillating characters have been created, this tribe comprised completely of warrior women who are meant to be the most fierce, the most terrifying, like the original dominatrix, and yet they continuously get put into their place when it comes to the myths, because you couldn't actually, because whilst they're nice and in terms of an idea, they can't actually be seen to win against the heroes, which were of course the male armies.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, everyone's really stoked when Andromache and I mean somebody else, another A word. She was queen of the Amazons and she was in her 40s. Turned up for one of the climactic battles of Troy, and I was like, this is great, this is a middle-aged woman leading her own army to the aid of this great and powerful city. She doesn't come to a very good end, and it's an end that doesn't make Achilles look very good either, in fairness, but I won't go into that. But but yeah, they're really built up to be this almost semi-divine, fierce, monstrous, unnatural group of women, in order for men to defeat them. And it's the whole sort of powerful women are threatening to men thing. And it's like the Wheel of Time series, which admittedly I've only read the first three books of because I kind of got a bit bored. Well, there's 14 books, Madeline.
No, it's a joke that I had with someone else I knew who read the books, and basically we concluded that nothing ever happens. Like, at the end of the first book, you know, they've had breakfast and they've left the house and they've got to the bottom of the lane.
It is. But, I mean, again, they have this massive group of women who specialise in very particular magic, and the magic in the Wheel of Time world is not supposed to be wielded by men. So this group of women, I can't remember the name of the order, I'm afraid, I think it's the out something or other, hunt down men and kill them. And then it's very noticeable that a lot of these women are lesbians.
Yes.
So it's trope on trope on trope, and it's just like...
That's the agenda, isn't it?
Yes. So that's one that perhaps could be done differently. And I think we need to be getting away from the idea of segregating groups too much in fiction now. Unless you've got a really good reason. Unless, you know, perhaps you, there's only one gender in your universe if you're writing sci-fi.
Yeah.
Which I have seen very well.
And again, there is nothing wrong if you do decide to do it. But I do tend to agree that a lot of people go, but we're going to have this band of powerful women, which shows that I'm not sexist. And I just think it feels kind of like you're compensating, to be honest, if kind of that's what it is. It makes me think about that that shot in Endgame, Avengers Endgame, where you have all of the female characters all together in that one shot.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, we are doing.
And this is meant to be a really empowering moment, and you're like, none of these people actually really have any form of relationship with one another. And it's kind of a bit of a shame. Like, I still loved the shot visually. I thought it was good. But in terms of actually what it gave, not a lot. So it's all very good saying, look, I've been a feminist. I've included this band of amazing warriors, particularly if you've got this band of female warriors, and we only really get to know maybe one of those characters, or we don't even really get to know any of them, if they're kind of just faceless.
Yeah.
That it's not really feminism, it just feels like compensation. But it depends how you do it.
It's also really noticeable with these groups of powerful women that a lot of the time they're not going head to head with other groups of people. What they're doing is they are manipulating things behind scenes, they're the power behind the throne. The fact that someone has to go around and do it that way suggests that they are not actually in power.
Yeah, there's also there's two kinds of things when you get these kind of powerful women. Either they're totally fascinated by men and they are desperate to have sex with men because they're like, oh, we've been deprived and oh, how exotic. Or they totally hate men and they're deeply suspicious of them. And there's never any in between. There's never any, you just happen to be a guy.
You've just got me thinking about Monty Python and Holy Grail. I was like, spanking,
that's
spanking.
Exactly what I was thinking of.
Because like, obviously yeah. They have all these women walled up in a castle. That's exactly what they're thinking. Which is funny, yeah. Monty Python, it is deliberately played that way for laughs. But
yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it's always kind of one or the other. They're either obsessed by, but they're always obsessed by men in some way, either by thinking that they're all terrible and then being proven wrong, or by being absolutely fascinated by them and wanting them.
Yeah.
And it's always, they always play it off like they've never ever seen men before. And you're right, that there's often the lesbian side of that as well, which always gets me. It really amuses me because it makes this really grand assumption that lesbians, A, don't have, you know, fathers, brothers, family members or friends who are male. It's just lesbians are born and automatically surrounded by women. So yeah, I don't really understand where that comes from. It's the tropiest of tropes. But yeah.
But a good example of one that does get it right is Mark Lawrence's Red Sister series, whereby the main character, Nona Grey, is an orphan who ends up joining this order of very, very talented nuns who do have a high political stake in things. And, you know, they're basically battle nuns and assassins, and they're just really great. But there are still men in the series. Almost all the main characters are female, which is a refreshing change. But it doesn't matter because the characters are all characters rather than being sort of, here is the token warrior female character, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. They're very human, which is something we'll get into a bit later on. So it can definitely be done. You can definitely have these gender segregations and actually make them work. The whole point is with these nunneries, that's where these women go to learn particular skills. And there are male equivalents, it's just they're not really relevant in that story.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. That's the thing for me, though, is that a powerful woman is absolutely fine in terms of a character, as long as they're a character rather than just a symbol.
Going on to our next item on the agenda, it's male heroes talk down to women, and I think I'll lump in gendered insults with that as well.
Okay. So you get this particularly in some of the older stuff.
Yeah, and it's
but still today.
It's a difficult one. We're looking at things like threats, insults, and belittling pet names without permission kind of thing. The Princess Bride, for example, is one of my favourite films ever. And yet there is a point in it where Wesley, disguised as the Dread Pirate Roberts, has just rescued Buttercup from the little group of thieves who were holding hostage. And he gets into an argument with her because she's now technically engaged to Prince Humperdinck. And she said, well, you know, I don't feel anything. I lost Wesley, and she's clearly still grieving. And he accuses her of lying, and he belittles her, and he says her love wasn't worth very much. And when she still insists that she's telling the truth, he actually raises his fist as if to backhand her.
Yikes.
And it's one of those things that I caught myself mentally skipping over that happening in the film. And it's still one of my favourite films, but I think I need to remember that that's in there. And it's actually not okay. It's not okay to have the threat of violence there and you're a liar just because you're a woman. That's not cool.
Yeah.
And this is going back, you know, it was made in the 80s. And it's a cult classic, but that's something that probably didn't need to be there.
No, I agree with you.
So there's that. And then there's things like... insults tend to be gendered, so I mean, you can pry the word bitch out of my cold dead hands because I will use that and I don't care what gender you are. So it is a your mileage may vary type thing. On the other hand, there are gendered insults which are actually anything that's using a female body part is considered to be worse than saying the male equivalent, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. A good example is if you call someone a dick, it's actually a relatively tame comparison than if you use the C word, which I'm not even going to use.
Yeah, see, I don't necessarily have a problem with the C word, but I can't actually step aside from the fact that most people see that as a very gendered insult, and the fact that I kind of see it from the Catelyn Moran perspective, whereby, wow, it's, you know, top trumps of insults, as in, you know, the lady parts kind of like are the ones that can make the vicar faint kind of thing, so it's a power word. Not everybody can get on board with that, and that's okay.
Yeah. It also makes me think of recently I watched a little bit of Extraordinary League of Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Which I really liked when I was younger. It's just a fun film, and because I like the gothic as well, it was really nice to see these kind of gothic characters being used. And there was one bit that kind of actually really annoyed me on the rewatch, which is that Sean Connery's character is very very dismissive towards Mina Harker.
Yeah.
And he kind of sort of, in the end, he really doesn't want her around. He thinks she's going to be a liability. And in the end, his sort of form of apology is the fact that he says, you know, I've, you know, known lots of women and they've all died. And it really annoyed me because basically what he was basing it on the fact that he'd had girlfriends and a wife and stuff like that who'd all perished. And because of that, he didn't want a woman with whom he was not romantically involved, with whom he had no involvement at all, on the mission, as if by virtue of her being on the mission, she was somehow involved with him, as if there was feelings there. Now, I can kind of understand saying, oh, well, look, I'm in a relationship with you. I'm not sure I want you on this dangerous mission. That's very different to, no, you're a woman. You shouldn't be on this mission because I myself happen to have lost female friends and companions in the past. It just really pissed me off.
Yeah, well, it's like that professor a few years ago who said, oh, and he meant it as a joke, I think, but it was very, very tone deaf. And he said, the trouble with women in the labs are the fact that they either fall in love with me, I fall in love with them, or they start crying. Which started the whole hashtag too sexy to work in a lab type thing, which was very, very funny. And, you know, leaving aside the fact whether you felt he deserved to lose his job over that, which I don't necessarily, because that's something that could have been changed with a little bit of conversation, in my opinion. It's that attitude, and that's an attitude that I've come up against all my life, because it's what it's literally saying is, this is not meant for your gender. These things are not for you. I'm not surprised it annoyed you. Your prescribed roles are different.
Yeah, and it was also the fact that in the end he accepts Mina. But the only reason he accepts Mina is because she happens to be a vampire. And she proves her worth in that regard. God. Yeah. And for me, that doesn't actually solve anything, because she's the one female character in the entire film.
Okay, the next one. Women existing to serve men. Now, if you've got a book or a film or something, and all the female characters seem to be the supportive love interest, or the devoted mother, etc., etc., are they all nurturers? Does it always fall on them to provide comfort, to be the compassionate one, to reach out? Are they providing support, emotional support continually for the male characters, or do they have agendas in their own right? And if it's the former, then yeah, that book or film is pretty sexist.
Yeah. I think the big problem is that there's just this, particularly when it's meant to be a kind of relationship between two characters. If the female character is always giving emotional support to the male character, and you never see an exchange of that, then it's not actually a good relationship, and it's a very sexist portrayal, as this idea that women are supposed to kind of bear the burdens of their husbands, or be soothers or nurturers, rather than a relationship being nurturing on both sides.
Yeah, definitely. And it does kind of lead us into the next trope, which is that women are missing entirely. This is a big epic fantasy thing whereby you meet the hero at the beginning and there's no women in his family. There's no mother, there's no grandmother, there's no sisters, there's no female cousins. and it's kind of like, did you spring out of the ground? Seriously? And they never talk about these female relatives who are just missing either. Which I've also paired with lone representation, or and she's the love interest.
Feel like you get the missing mother sometimes.
You do. It's not just the missing mother, though. It's the missing anyone else. And, okay, take for example, Terry Goodkind's The Sword of Truth series. The first book, The Wizard's First Rule, you meet Richard Rull. We get, like, 6 pages of blah, 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 blah. I have this, I've suffered that, etc. His mentor character, Zed, we meet him as well. And then sort of about 30% of the way through the book, we meet the first female character who's actually going to be on page for any length of time. There's one minor female character before that, but we realise she's an ex-girlfriend who cheated on Richard, who he dumped quite righteously. And then you meet Kaylin, sort of 30% of the way through. And even though she's kind of a badass female character in her own right, or she should be with the power set she's got, she's the love interest. Mm-hmm. And there's right up until Richard gets kidnapped by the Maud Sith, which is clearly kind of a bondage fantasy that Terry Goodkind has and decided to splurge on the page. It's so bizarre, seriously. It's like the Mary Whitehouse experience, where you've got the guy painting the fields and saying how lovely it is, and then noticing the shadow and going black, black, black. It's just that random.
Okay.
It's so bizarre. Yeah, because obviously you have the good girl, if you like, with long hair, dressed in white. She's pure, mm-hmm. She can't have sex with anybody, because if she does, she'll lose her powers, etc., etc., etc. And then he gets kidnapped by the Maud Sith, who are red leather wearing, weapon wielding, sort of badass ninja chicks who take men and torture them into compliance. And it's very weird and very non consensual BDSM, put it that way. And those are the two female characters that stick out in this 600 page book. In fairness, there's the dragon. There's the female dragon as well. There's three female characters then.
Okay, fantastic. and they're both kind of extremes in the opposite directions.
Yeah, and they're both, you could argue, they're both kind of love interests, because they both have some sort of sexual connection with Richard.
Yeah.
And the dragon obviously doesn't, but...
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for clarifying that.
You never can tell these days.
Yeah, but thank you for clarifying that. I think earlier when I said the kind of the missing mother, what I meant is that particularly in YA, you often have the case where you have this male hero whose mother has died, or whose mother has gone missing.
Yeah.
and they think on this missing mother. They ruminate on this missing mother who, by virtue of not being there, becomes the ultimate nurturing figure.
Yeah, well, she can't do anything wrong, can she?
No, she can only be this presence of comfort which continues to exist perpetually, which is perfect and never complains, never gets in the way, never has any other kind of characteristic beyond being that comforter for the main character. Again, nothing wrong with that. Lord knows I've used it as well, because dead parents are really good in children's fiction.
Yeah.
But when you've got a story whereby it's a male character and the only female presence in it is one, the dead mother or the absent mother and her memory and the love interest, we really start to lose something, and we really do start to put forward this idea that women are either lovers or mothers.
Yeah, or it's really, particularly bad chick, you know?
Yes, but it's particularly prevalent, I think, when you have a female character who does have amazing power, or who does have, you know, agency of their own, and they end up giving up part of their journey or part of themselves for the male character and simply become that character's lover.
Yeah, definitely.
And their aid and their support. The moment you remove agency from a female character so that she can fit into a certain role is the moment you've got a real problem.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Okay, the next one is kind of a classic, irritating one, and it's one that sort of followed me all the way up through my teen years, because I'll explain in a moment, but it's the natural beauty. It's the idea of the male lead being obsessed with a woman who is naturally beautiful, which, you know, already that's subjective. That's a very subjective thing, isn't it? Whether somebody is beautiful or not. But then to say, it's the suggestion that women must be beautiful, so that you have one side of the dichotomy, and then on the other side, but it must be attained naturally. They must not have spent an hour on hair and makeup, because if they are, then they're basically advertising under false pretenses.
Yeah. As if women worked.
And I can't count the number of times I've read generally a male-written book, actually, with male lead characters, and sometimes female lead characters, where the main female character bounces out of bed looking like she's just spent 2 hours in a salon. And it's just like, we don't look like that. We get bedhead and, you know, we look bleary-eyed. And
I think the thing is that there's a big difference between looking at somebody, you know, before they've put on any makeup, before they've made any effort with their appearance, and finding them beautiful.
Yeah.
And that character being, having to be beautiful before they've done all those things. Because I do think that actually sometimes people look their best when they've kind of not made any effort, if that makes sense, when they are just them being their most relaxed selves.
Yeah. But you wouldn't then say your makeup makes you ugly, would you? Because the point
no,
is that
absolutely
that's,
not.
That's a subjective thing. And
yeah. I think you're right in that, yeah, in fiction, what happens is that instead of that it being portrayed in that very healthy way, which is, gosh, I really, really love seeing you like this, all happy and relaxed. You look absolutely beautiful to me, more so than when you're all jazzed up because you're making, you know, you look beautiful to me now. And I think the problem is that rather than that being a kind of a genuine emotional thing, it's about this idea of demonizing makeup for a start, but also this effortless beauty, as you say. And it's particularly used, weirdly enough, the strong woman thing, which is, we don't need makeup makeup. We're not here to impress men, but we happen to be very beautiful regardless.
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, it's kind of an urban fantasy thing as well.
Yeah.
It's very... I don't want to pick on Harry Dresden, but it turns up a lot in Harry Dresden. I'm sorry, it's one of the things I noticed. Obviously, I do really like the Dresden Files, but it's a case of... It's very noticeable Harry's attitude to women who are clearly highly maintained and wear a lot of makeup as being perceived as less morally valuable than women who just seem to be naturally beautiful and don't make too much of an effort. I won't necessarily pick apart examples, but it's definitely there. And the trouble is, Harry Dresden kind of set one bar on the urban fantasy ladder, and then a lot of imitators came along, including female writers, and they sort of assumed this must be how you have to present things. So you've got Kim Harrison, who writes the Hollows series, and you find her starting to do some of the similar things with her characters. But the problem is, when you've got a female writer doing it, and she's writing from the perspective of a main female character, and all her other female characters are kind of like, well, this one's naturally beautiful, this one isn't. It comes off as girl-on-girl hate, and it's horrible. It's really, really bad.
Yeah.
So, and it does play into that whole not like the other girls trope that you mentioned earlier, Madeline.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real shame, though, because, to be honest, when I look around, I tend to find that most people are actually beautiful. Like, there's very few people who are genuinely ugly. That's, you know?
That's the beauty of being a demisexual, though, isn't it? Because you look at somebody and... I don't know about you, but I tend to notice people's best features first anyway, and then if they turn out to be like a half-decent person, I'm just like, oh, well, they look like them, and they are a beautiful person kind of thing.
Yeah.
So...
When I was reading these things, it was just like, oh, she was naturally beautiful, and like subconsciously I went, yeah, fair enough, pretty much everybody is.
That's fine. Anyways, it was one of those things that was really reinforced for me, and I think it was partly reinforced for me because being sent to a convent school, they were very, very strict on having a no makeup policy, and the idea there was just this undertone of, you know, makeup is for whores kind of thing. Why would you be trying to draw attention to yourself? It was never said, but it was an undertone that was there. And was there all the way through, up through my teenage years, and a case of, oh, well, you know, I wouldn't want to be with her because, you know, you don't know what you're getting when she scrubbed her face kind of thing. I heard that from a lot of male friends. So on one hand, it was a case of, yeah, you must be really attractive, but on the other hand, it must be, you must not be using any aids to achieve it.
it must just be natural.
Yeah, it's a terrible position to put a teenage girl in. As well. And on the other hand, it's kind of like, well, teenage boys probably feel very similar in some ways, but they're not expected to be as decorative. So at least they're dodging that bullet.
We could probably do a whole episode on the pros and cons of makeup, to be honest.
Yeah, on the whole thing of the female body. Anyway, let's move on to the next one. We talked about gendered insults. Let's look at the female hero is forced to demean herself.
Yes. Okay, so let's think of one of the most famous examples. Leia.
Yeah. Oddly, that's the one that popped into my head when I was writing the list. I was like, oh, can I think of an example? Yes, I can. Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, even the way that she kills... it is Jabba the Hutt.
Yes.
Yeah, even the way she kills Jabba the Hutt. Sorry, my brain went so quiet there. I was like, what was his name? The big blobby guy. No, you don't know Star Wars. Madeline, but yeah, even when she killed...
Referring to the fact that Princess Leia from the original Star Wars films was forced into a gold bikini by Jabba the Hutt in the third film to be an enslaved dancing girl.
Yeah. And in the end, she kills Jabba the Hutt by basically strangling him with her own chain. Even that is, I mean, I mean, I guess you could say it's symbolic, a slave literally murdering their master with their own, bonds, with their own shackles. But the fact that she's there, she's in that bikini, she's got this long kind of elegant chain, and she's choking somebody.
Yeah, and it's always demeaning in a sexual way, generally, with these female characters. And the thing with Star Wars is, in the first three films, Leia is the most together and competent character out of the main three. There's no question. She is the most probably skill set rounded person out of all three of them. You don't notice Han Solo being forced into a gold bikini. No, he got... he got turned into an interesting piece of artwork on a wall, admittedly. But it's not quite the same thing, is it? There's another example. There's Polgara the Sorceress by David Eddings. And Polgara, again, is a really, really good female character. She's one of the most powerful semi-immortal beings. She's a sorceress in her own right. And during this prequel novel... which tells the backstory before the Belgariad. Polgara's kind of like reminiscing about her life, and one big section of it is she had to be owned by a man in one particular society, so she was kind of sold into slavery with her consent, admittedly, which makes the whole thing even a bit weirder. So she was technically owned by him, because in this society women had to be owned. There's already a big problem there. And she just generally... earned her keep by doing very sexy dances. I mean, she never slept with this man. She wasn't, like, married to him or anything like that. But it's the whole, yes, I'm here to do... I'm here for titillation purposes and to be decorative and to add to your status. At one point, she even sort of negotiates her own sale in order to get a better price because she thinks she should be valued more highly. But this is not Take Back the Night stuff. It's pretty dicey.
Yeah. It's just this idea that when you get these very, powerful female characters, in order to be demeaned and stuff like that, in order to kind of be destroyed, it's almost always involves sexual violence.
Yeah, going back to the thing about insults, you don't generally forget a male character telling another male character that he'll fuck him to death, kind of thing. That's not... It's like, well, wait till I get out of here, I'll rape you to death, kind of thing, which is something that's popped up in something I've been watching recently. So, yeah, it's always a case of the worst possible thing that can happen to you is that you will lose your virtue, almost.
Yeah. And it is always sexual violence as well. In fact, if you really want to make a character... really evil, you make him sexually violent towards men. That's how you know a character is apparently really evil. Whereas a character who's just casually evil, in fact, any bad character usually will be sexually violent towards women when put into that position. It's almost seen as a hallmark, it was why I liked Kingpin so much in Daredevil, was because he wasn't just random. He was obviously meant to be evil, but he wasn't just randomly sexually violent against women. He was just violent in general, but actually kind of respectful of women.
Yeah. Okay, the next one's one that kind of makes me laugh, because anybody who has any experience in this area at all knows that it's utter bollocks. And that's separate fighting styles. And this is something I see pop up on forums and things, and it's like, well, how would a woman fight? I'm like, well, like a bloke? How do men fight, kind of thing? What style are we talking? Are we talking swords? Are we talking pistols? Are we talking a martial art or something more esoteric? It's a stupid question. It's a stupid question. Women are bipedal quadrupeds who are part of the hominid family. they come from the same primate type background as men do. Therefore, we will utilise the same basic tools that men will use when fighting. Now, if you want to say, what would a smaller or less strong character or less physically powerful character fight like, then yeah, that's a question, because there are things a smaller fighter can do that a bigger fighter can't. and there are things a smaller fighter must do in order to ensure a chance of success that a bigger fighter doesn't have to worry about. I will say quite honestly that I agree with Jay Kristoff's statement that anybody who thinks that fighting somebody twice your size doesn't matter has never fought somebody half their own size. And having fought lots of people who are twice my size, very nearly, it does make a difference if they get hold of you, but it doesn't, it's never a game over thing necessarily. So it's just a case of, think physics, okay? Fighting is basically physics. It's that simple. It's a separate sexy fighting style because the character is female. It's just, please don't make me laugh. Seriously. Yeah. It's the curved breastplate thing again, isn't it?
It is. It's also this idea that it's this weird obsession with women being flexible. Have you noticed that?
It's not... Okay, women might be, but it's bizarre. It's just men can be as flexible, women can be as flexible. Some women can be stronger than some men. Pound for pound, power-wise, an optimally fit man and an optimally fit woman, there isn't actually that much difference. Genuinely isn't. So,
And
it's a difference of degree, not kind.
Yeah, and it is visual. It's meant to be visual because actually... When he's wielding a huge, you know, claymore, he's showing off the attributes that we're meant to see as attractive in a male figure, which is, you know, the bulging, you know, biceps. He's meant to, you know, be putting real effort into it, his whole body, and it's sort of into that thrust, and it's meant to be this big, powerful kind of movement. His face, you know, crying out. You know, he's sweating. It's meant to be this big kind of warrior sort of statement. Apparently, they just don't want that in women. It's got to be sexy. So they go for something which is flashier. They go for something which is quicker, which uses a lot more body movement. That doesn't necessarily make sense, because really you want to conserve energy, particularly if you're in a big, big fight, and which involves lots of kind of twirling and showing off. Now, I love that style just as much as anyone when I watch movies, because it just looks visually fantastic. So absolutely fine. But this idea that women... that this is a natural style for women because they are women is kind of ludicrous and doesn't really make sense at all.
No, it really doesn't. And, you know, visually spectacular fighting actually isn't always the most effective fighting. I can understand why they'd use it in film, but writing that in a book is just daft. It really, really is.
Yeah.
So there's that. I will mention the whole... connection between this is so stupid, weaponry and sex when it comes to women fighting in fantasy. And there's a good example of this is the really, really clunky, cheesy film Red Sonja from, again, 1980s. And I really like that film, but it's dreadful at the same time. You have Red Sonja herself. Guess why she's called Red Sonja? Guess what nickname followed me all the way up through my 20s? Her backstory is that her village was destroyed, her entire family was killed, and she was raped and just left there. So she sort of gang raped and left. You never see any of this happen. It was just, you get the voice of God at the beginning sort of saying that this is what happened.
Right.
She goes on a mission of revenge, and she learns to use a sword pretty damn well. And she swears that no man shall have her unless he takes her by force, which is already pretty bad. And it's getting to the point where she does actually want to sleep with Arnold Schwarzenegger's character, who's definitely not Conan the Barbarian, by the way. And and it's getting to the point where they clearly really like each other, but instead of her just saying, you know what, I was wrong, I can heal from this, I can make a better future, we've destroyed the evil priesthood that caused the death of my family, etc., etc. I'm going to put my sword aside. If you want to put your sword aside, I think we might have some sexy times coming, because I am over this, or as over it as I can be. But no. She pulls her sword out and they start fighting, and they're sort of half fighting and then snogging and then fighting and snogging, and it's kind of like, this is just so weird. So there's that side of it. And it's also that rape is a backstory. It's just so lazy. I tell you what, if somebody burned down my entire town and killed my entire family, you wouldn't need to worry about raping me. I'm still coming for you. I'm on my revenge arc, okay? That was enough of a reason.
I feel like I should mention this is not us saying that there shouldn't be rape in stories, that shouldn't be something that you write about, because it's a reality, it does happen, and it's fine to write about it. It is just basically about it being weirdly and exclusively a female form of punishment, which is maybe the ultimate.
Yeah.
When really pretty much anything you could do to a male character as the ultimate would be the same for a female character. Just as actually if you submitted a male character to sexual violence, that would also be pretty damn awful too.
Yeah.
So it's just about exclusivity, really.
It's that, and it's don't codify rape. So don't codify a rapist as just being a bad guy. Don't use this guy rapes people as code for he's a bad guy, but never really examine it. And don't use rape as code for she had a difficult backstory. She's had things to overcome. This is why she turned into a fighter. This is why she's become an unnatural woman who is not naturally a nurturer. That's lazy writing. Stop doing it. I'm not even going to say that part of the trope is okay. It's not okay anymore. Stop doing it. Okay, slightly different. Enigmatic decision making. This is a good one. When a male character makes a decision, he looks at the facts, he looks at the variables, he looks at the likelihood and the strengths and weaknesses of both sides, and he makes a decision. Most of us make the decision the same way, whether it's, shall I have pie or shall I have a sandwich? What are the pros and cons? When a female fantasy or science fiction character does it, for some reason she needs to consult her astrological chart, throw some runes, look into the future, find out which house the moon is going to be in that week. And we make decisions the same way. So unless your female character has some sort of ability that makes her privy to knowledge other people would not normally have, don't have her be a really weird, wafty decision maker.
Yeah, I completely agree. But again, if you want to have a character like that, then go for it. But I think you are right that there is this prevailing trope whereby with the female characters, they have to rely upon some kind of mystic instinctual thing, or consult some sort of magical talisman in order to kind of make decisions.
It's the whole women's intuition thing. It's like, no, it's just human intuition. If women have slightly more of it, it's because they're used to not being listened to, therefore they tend to pick up social cues better. But that's entirely a socialised thing, so bear that in mind in your stories.
I think a really nice example of actually one where that's been completely subverted is the TV series Bones.
I've never
Which has its other problems. It's quite good. It's quite good. The first few series are quite good, and then it kind of went off a bit. But it's quite nice in that you have the main character, Brennan, or Bones, who is completely logical, almost to a fault, basically. Yeah. And then you have Booth, who is played by David Boreanaz.
Yeah.
Who is he's a cop, he's salt of the earth, he has kind of this gut instinct and his faith and things like that as well. So you have a little bit of a swap there. But it's kind of meant to be this play on, oh, isn't that unusual? We have a female character who's not naturally nurturing, and a male character who kind of is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's a play on the trope, which is actually relying on the trope, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, one that has bugged me for my entire life is the is feistiness. Now, first of all, feisty actually comes from an Anglo-Saxon word meaning flatulent, so you might not want to use that word. So, are you really saying that she's flatulent? Anyway, so there's that. Admittedly, this is a word issue for me, and I appreciate that I'm a bit pedantic about the whole thing and that not everybody feels the same way, and that's fine. But it's the whole devaluing of female anger, and one of the worst culprits is actually anime in general. How many times have you watched anime and had someone say, oh, she's pretty cute when she's angry, and I've always wanted to meet a feisty girl like you. I like a girl yeah. with spirit, etc, etc. And it's kind of like, I just want to strangle those male characters. Like, when we feel anger, it's just as valid as a bloke feeling anger. So please stop demeaning that.
Yeah. Also, it's just, I didn't have a problem necessarily with the word feisty itself. Now, however, thanks for that gift, Jules.
You're welcome. I'll never be able
to read that word again. I'm going to tell everybody. Me, I'm going to tell them so that they can suffer too. So I didn't necessarily have a problem with the word. It's kind of what it came to represent. And you're right that it represents this belittling of true feelings. Because you certainly don't have a feisty male character. Not an adult. You could maybe have a feisty child. But again, you wouldn't use it for an adult, so it's meant to be, or an adult male, meant to kind of be demeaning in some way, which is not great, to be honest.
No, it's propping up that norm of, you know, at the top of the pyramid you have fully grown adult man, and then below that you have slightly older men, and then you have, you know, women, girls, children, boys, etc., etc., all the way down. But what everyone should be aiming for, and what most of us are missing, because we're not all male or adult men, it is that the top of that pyramid. That's the norm. That's what we should be going for, and everything else is kind of like a step down from that.
Yeah.
So, bit of an issue. Again, it's the this next one is the femininity balance, and it's the idea that femininity itself is wrong, it's bad. So anything a woman can do will be a greater sin than anything a man can do. So a girl cannot be, a female character rather, cannot be too girly, because girliness is wrong and we must sneer at it. And mm-hmm. she cannot be too masculine, or rather she cannot be attracted or connected with things that are considered the possession of people who are male.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, though, when it comes to femininity, it's allowed. It's allowed if it's family members.
Yeah.
In other words, if it's a little sister, then they're meant to be kind of annoying. Or if it's an anime, they're meant very cute. But if it's a mother, then she's allowed to be feminine in the case of that she's baking, she's warm, she's nurturing, she spoils them, she never really raises her voice, she's always doing the laundry, her outfit is an apron with a nice sort of dress, and she wears the ponytail, which hangs down one shoulder and looks just genuinely kind of feminine and nice and sweet.
Yeah. The thing with the whole sort of balance of femininity thing is that the female MC, we must be regularly reminded that she is attractive. So she's not too girly, she's not too masculine, but she is in the middle and she is still attractive. It's really important that we know, and we get told this regularly.
Yeah.
So again, we're back to the whole natural beauty, not like the other girls thing.
Yeah. I think also the other big problem with the whole femininity aspect and the weird demonization of it, but also the expectation of it, is that it actually really affects the male characters and how they're perceived, because any femininity on their part is seen as negative, which is damaging on a whole other level. You know, it's worth reminding people that feminism is not just for women, it's for everybody.
Yeah.
So the moment you basically say that any of these things which fall into this category, which anyone can do or be part of or feel, are weaker and wrong, you are limiting people. So you have this male character who can't get in touch with any or can't done any of these things, or if they do, they are a point of ridicule because of it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't like that.
No, I mean, I really appreciated in Tamora Pierce's Becca Cooper series, in the third book, there is a character called a mage character called Farmer, and he's not a particularly good mage, but he's very good at using scraps of leftover magic. And he does this because he makes intricate embroidery, and he also knits and crochets. So what he does to relax is basically needlework, and he's very good at it.
Aww.
And he gets sneered at by some characters, but other characters are like, wow, that's amazing. Can you do one of my tunics? No, can I borrow one of your shawls? You make the warmest knitted shawls. And it was just such a nice thing to do. He's still a masculine character, and he doesn't think any of the less of himself because he likes to do needlework. And he said, well, you know, I had five sisters and my mother was a professional seamstress. So she taught all of us and she taught me as well. So I'd always have something to fall back on. So I really liked that. We kind of did talk about segregated gender roles, and I kind of missed this one earlier, but I do want to just mention gender-based magic systems. And my big problem with having a gender-based magic system, as great as it potentially looks initially to say, oh, well, this is the special prerogative of women, is that, first of all, when you have a gender-based magic system, there will always be a male character who crops up who is an anomaly, who is like the second coming, is a messianic figure, and his magic will always turn out to be stronger. So there's that.
Yeah.
And it's also, where does somebody who is transsexual fit into that? Where does someone who's non-binary or gender neuter, or, you know, someone who is male on one day or female on another day, where do they fit in? So
yeah,
you're raising just a huge section of society by doing that. So
it's not just an erasure, it's actually a complete attack as well, because you know what they're going to say. It's going to, oh, well, you know, it's all about biology, as if that's the thing necessarily, you know, what your genitals are is actually what defines your sex. And so by making something which is intrinsic to biology, it also completely misunderstands the fact that, yes, genitals one thing, but there's actually all sorts of different things that happen in biology which can affect your gender. So I really don't like it at all.
No, so, and I'm not going to bother giving examples. I mentioned some of the segregation things earlier, and they were linked to magic or, you know, other special skills. It's intensely problematic, and I think it's something that we could do with less of, to be honest, in science fiction. There are better ways to express this. Even when someone's tried to do a take back, when you have, say, things like The Way of Kings by Brandon Sanderson, whereby all the men are kind of politicians, leaders, rulers kind of thing, but all the women are, this is where it gets ridiculous, are scientists and mathematicians. So women hold all the power science-wise, and men hold it all through politics and rulership, etc. And it's impossible that women would not have gained some kind of power politically through the application of science or discovery. So it just, for a start, it doesn't make sense. And again, you've got that single divide. It just doesn't really work. So I will mention in this next one, the whole idea of sexual abstinence, the idea that the female character, this is such a Hollywood thing as well. It's the idea that an actress must appear to be sexually available, but she also mustn't be going around and having sex. So it's that razor's edge of you must be walking it. You cannot appear to be frigid, but you also must not appear to be giving it away to everyone kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's actually things within, for Japanese actors and stuff like that, and Japanese pop stars, that it's actually within their contracts that they're not allowed to be having at the very least open relationships.
Yeah.
Because they've got to sell this illusion to their fans that they're available, which is disgusting.
Yeah.
Really disgusts me.
And you definitely see it with female characters. As in, if she's going to qualify as being a main female character, she must not be regularly having sex with other people.
Yeah.
And it... That's a problem, because what that is saying is that sexual activity equals moral value.
Yeah.
I personally like Kushiel's Dart for this, in the sense of once Phaedra has actually earned out her indenture and received her mark, she makes decisions on who she's going to sleep with. She does have a long-term relationship with her partner, Jocelyn, but because of what she particularly likes, they eventually come to an agreement whereby she will take 3 clients a year, because she wants to do particular things that Jocelyn's kind of like, I'm just not really attracted to that, but I don't want to live without you, so we'll just have an agreement whereby you go off and have 3 sexual adventures a year, and we'll not go into detail about it because I don't want the details. And there's no moral value placed on her for that. I mean, when she's sent out as a diplomat, she said, look, you're sending a courtesan out as a diplomat. You know I'm going to end up getting into bed with these people, quite literally, because this is what I'm trained to do.
Yeah.
There's no moral value placed on that. That's just a case of, no, this is how I personally connect with people. You could argue that she is a naturally polyamorous person because she doesn't believe there should be a limit on love and affection, and it, in consequence with sexual congress with people for that very reason. So I think there are probably problems with that series now, but that does actually quite work, and it's nice to see a female character whereby she's obviously having quite a lot of sex and some of it's really, really kinky, but she's not she's not being held up as being basically available to anyone, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. It really sounds like an interesting series.
It's really good. You should read it. I think you'd really like it. The world building's amazing, for a start. I've mentioned it a few times now, I think. Also, it's set in a fantasy version of France, so not that you should like it because of that, but I haven't seen anything set quite so similarly. You must like it, it's set in France.
Well, you joke about that, but the fact that I remembered that that Lucas was French.
Oh, I like him a little bit now.
I like him a little bit more now because I remember he's French, and that changes everything.
This last one, I'm trusting Madeline to pull me back before I start to foam at the mouth too much, because this is one that's been bugging me so much. I've been rewatching Angel with my other half, and it's basically the way it really hammered it home for me. This is something that's always bugged me in speculative fiction, and it's the way that women's bodies are casually violated or commodified for the use of the male characters. I'm specifically talking here about mystical pregnancies. And the fact that the female character then has no value within the context of the story once she's been pregnant and conveniently dies. So I'm going to give you the 3 examples from Angel. The first one, Darla, a vampire, has sex with Angel, another vampire, and somehow impossibly conceives a child. And that ends her arc. Her arc could have been really, really interesting if they'd continued it. But what they end up doing is having Darla stake herself in order to give birth, because technically her body was dead, therefore it could not bring life into the world. So how it was like gestating a fetus, I don't know. The science clearly doesn't work there. So there's that. So you go mystical pregnancy and results in a male child, and there's nothing more the mother can do, so she just dies.
Right.
Cordelia is subjected to a mystical pregnancy early in the first season, because she goes out with a bloke, she decides she would like to have sex with him, and in the morning she wakes up about 8 months pregnant, with him gone, and it's, you know, a demonic pregnancy, a potentially demonic birth, and she loses both her bodily autonomy and her mental autonomy during the process of that episode. And it's really, really gross. It's like, could you not think of anything else to do with a female character? This would have been as interesting if something had laid an egg in a male character, you know?
Yeah.
It didn't have to be done in quite this way. And that was bad enough, but they subject her to it several more times. I'll talk about the last one in a minute, but there is also the fact that she gets to be this sort of semi-messianic figure who is fated to sleep with the great champion, the Gruslog, and lose her vision. So again, female body being co-modified for use for a male character. And it's like, yeah. Could you not think of another way of doing that?
Nope.
I will talk about Fred, or Winifred, from the final season, whereby she's infected by the remains, if you like, of Illyria, which is a sort of divine being from another hell dimension type thing. And yeah, she doesn't technically give birth, but she dies in the process of Illyria taking her over completely and coming into being. So it is very much a parallel pregnancy. And yeah. Again, you've got the complete erasure of a female character in order to bring forth another being that advances male story arcs. During the fourth season, Cordelia, as having spent some time as a higher being, comes back, seduces Angel's son, and then gets pregnant. Very fast demonic pregnancy again. And in the course of that pregnancy becomes evil. And then obviously gives birth to this goddess and dies. And it's just, that's the worst one of all. That's the slap in the face. Because I don't even really like Cordelia. I don't like where her character arc went from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when she suddenly became this self-aware, compassionate person who still did have a mean streak. It was interesting, but I didn't like her. But then everything about her character growth got turned around. Her compassion was now manipulation. Her ability to tell the truth was again used to lie and to force other characters to do what she wanted them to do, as she pulled strings behind the scenes. And it was just really, really gross. There's a lot written into the script whereby you've got the male characters talking, particularly Angel, talking to her in a very demeaning way, talking about the size of her breasts and things like that. And it's just, there could have been other ways, I think. She's just used as a sexual figure all the way through, right up until she gives birth, and then she's a non-entity again. She disappears.
Yeah. Now, the whole thing with kind of demonic babies and stuff like that, on the one side, I can understand, because, you know, that's thing within mythos and in mythology, you know being impregnated by the devil or by demons, so I can understand why it's been used, but I think that you're right that what happens is that instead of it just being something which is used because you happen to be drawing from that kind of mythos, you've got these stories whereby characters are only their wombs or their sexual organs, and once those have kind of been exhausted, they don't have a purpose anymore.
It's very noticeable that in a lot of these things, and Angel's not the only example, it's just very glaring when you watch the series back to back like this, whereby, you know, we've talked before about pregnancy being an easy answer for what to do with a female character. And that's always been an issue for me. And this is very much a case of, well, they don't get to be the heroes once they've... Because once a woman has become pregnant, she stops becoming an object of desire for men. So we're going to just gradually push her out of the show, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And also that once they're a mother, that's the only role they can be.
Yeah.
And they can no longer be kick-ass. They can no longer, you know, get on with any other aspect. They can certainly no longer be a hero, or if they are, it is still centered around the fact that, oh, they are a mother. And sometimes you can actually do that quite well, but other times you can't. Now, weirdly enough, I mentioned Bones earlier, and within Bones, the series, the character of Brennan does actually have, she does get pregnant and she does have a child. And then continues with her work, because she's obviously not a detective, but she sort of looks at remains, which is quite a visually disgusting job.
Yes.
And she certainly doesn't stop, and her pregnancy doesn't stop her either. So I did quite like the way that they did that, in that she doesn't become someone else entirely by, I say giving up, rather, she doesn't become someone else entirely by giving birth. She gains something, certainly, but she remains intrinsically the same, which I kind of liked.
Yeah, and that would be good. That would be nice to see a bit more of that. The default at the moment seems to be, well, once you hit the whole being pregnant thing, then that's it. You're kind of off the market, so we'll shuffle you to one side, or we'll kill you off entirely.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And the bit that always gets... The bit that always gets me is that it's like, okay, so two people come together, they have a child, they become parents. The father can still be an adventurer, but the mother can't?
Yeah, that's a serious issue. The other thing that really bugs me, and I guess this is going to be a bit of a contentious one for some people, is the fact that if it's an unwanted pregnancy, when they automatically go to, well, you must have the baby, and it's a case of, well... No, shall we explore the options? No, shall we explore the fact that I don't want a child, I don't want to be a mother, and therefore I'm not going to have it and give it up for adoption because I don't want to do that, and I don't want my body to just be used as a vehicle to bring another life into the world. So let's explore the options of ending the pregnancy. How about we do that kind of thing?
To think that you often get this narrative of mothers giving their lives so that their babies can be born, which... I think probably does happen in reality, but it's the fact that that's always the narrative, and you never at any point go, okay, it's you or the baby, right? I choose me, because I may have other children. We don't even know if this baby is going to survive. I'm sorry to lose it. I'm choosing myself. And certainly if they did do that, they would be seen as incredibly selfish characters. It would be seen as a very amoral thing to do, to give up on a child before it was born, to save your own life. And I don't think that's fair, really.
No, I don't think it is either. So that's one that really does annoy me. There's an inequality there. It's a case of, well, you have value right up until the fact that you're pregnant, and then whatever you're carrying has more value than you do. So your accumulated years of experience and skills and everything else don't count for anything against the potential of another life. So there's a real issue there, and I don't want to see that in fantasy and science fiction, to be honest.
No, I completely agree.
So, yes. So there we have it. We have our... I'm not sure... I lumped some of these together in order to save some time. But there's a lot of tropes there, and there are others, but these are the ones that particularly struck me as being a bit of a checklist for, you're writing something, is it sexist? Possibly. Have a look.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And I've got one for you this week. So this week I would like to recommend King of Scars by Leah Bardugo. Now, it is a sequel to both Six of Crows and the Grisha trilogy. Whilst you don't have to have read them, I think in order to get the best of the book and to really appreciate and understand it, you at least need to have read Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom. And honest, having a background, you know, knowledge of the Grisha trilogy does really help. That being said, if you are prepared for all of that reading, this is another great success by Leah Bardugo. Fantastic world building, very engaging characters. One thing I like about her is that she manages to write engaging characters who aren't necessarily immediately likable, but with whom, you know, you can sort of really grow towards. And as usual, her dialogue is just hilarious. She's writes with real wit, and the descriptions are vivid. It's wonderful, wonderful stuff. very, very much worth reading. And if you are a big fan of the Six of Crows lot, it's wonderful to see Nina again as well, and her life after those events in Crooked Kingdom.
I think that's why I didn't go back to the Grisha trilogy, because I read the first book and then I read Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom. And after that thing I have not forgiven the author for yet. I haven't gone back to the Grisha trilogy yet, but I will do it at some point. I do have King of Scars.
Yeah. So King of Scars, very, very much worth reading. The main character, Nikolai, is just excellent. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.